I'm reading from Psalm 139, verses 7 through 14. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. The word of God for the people of God.
All right. It's good to see you here this wonderful Sunday morning. So I just want to begin by acknowledging, so this little series that we're doing called Who Needs God, it's something that was actually given to us through North Point, a guy named Andy Stanley, which some of you may be familiar with. So the basic outline kind of for this, I want to acknowledge it does come from them. And then, of course, you'll get our own flavor to it, right? So that's how it always works. But I do have a question for you today. I'm not sure if you've ever thought about this. And there are times when I have wondered this myself. But why in the world do we even need to believe in God? Why do we have to believe in God? Why can't we just know? You'd think with something as important as God, that's something we would just know, right? Why would there ever be any doubt? Why would there ever be any question? Now, I don't know if you're honest. I'll just be honest with you. Sometimes I get a little frustrated with God. I'm like, God, why are you so hidden? You know, why aren't you more clear? Why? What's this whole thing? Why do I have to believe in you? I don't have to do that with my marriage. You know, I just know I'm married. I don't think to myself, if I just believe hard enough, I'm sure I'm married. You know, we don't do that, right? I don't do that with my kids. I don't think, I believe they're my kids. A God-given gift. If I could just have enough faith, then I'd know they're my kids. No, they're just my kids. So this is kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? Kind of a weird dilemma that we face is, as human beings in this whole, our whole relationship with God. Whether you know, we believe in a God or there is no God, or whether it's a personal God, or, you know, there's just all kinds of things out there. Many questions by many people. So why, with something that is so extraordinarily important like God, do we have to have faith? Why is God something we have to believe in? And why is it so difficult to believe? It seems like I've said, we should just know. Now, I realize that some of you today, sitting in the room, you have extraordinary faith. That's awesome, you know? Some of us, well, we have kind of shaky faith. We have faith, but maybe it's not quite as strong. Others, I don't know if they're in the room, but maybe watching online, have lost faith. And unfortunately, I know a number of people and have read a number of stories of people. They've just lost their faith. And there's reasons for that that we'll kind of touch on here today. Some of us may be trying to regain our faith. We feel we've lost something and we're struggling through trying to figure out how to gain that back. And some of us don't think we could ever know anyway. In fact, a lot of people, I think, feel that way. You just can't really know one way or the other. So I'm not going to really worry about it. So here's all these kind of options that are out there, all these ideas and thoughts and things that we wrestle with. And I think we should, we need to understand that these wrestlings aren't just with ourselves, you know. Like, even those of us in the church and others sitting right next to you, I think if we're honest, again, I'm a pastor, and there are times where I'm like, God, like, where are you? Like, what are you doing? You know, like, I just am not seeing it. But fortunately, God has kept his hand upon me and helped me to keep at least journeying in the right direction, or I would consider it the right direction. So while we're kind of contemplating these different opinions and trying to figure it all out, I just want to point out to you something that's kind of an amazing fact. And that fact is that right now, as we are sitting or standing here in this place, we are hurtling around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. Now you tell me. Now I know that it's called gravity, right? But 67,000 miles per hour, and you and I feel no effects of that whatsoever. We're just standing here, walking here, living here blissfully, going about our business while the earth is hurtling at 67,000 miles per hour. And it's amazing to me that we just don't go all flying off, right? It's kind of an amazing thing. Another little amazing fact that I'll just kind of highlight for you today is that, you know, it's that we're in what's called the Goldilocks zone. The earth is. You know what that means? The Goldilocks zone means it's not too cold and it's not too hot. It's just right. I mean, the earth is placed miraculously, I would say, in such a situation that it is perfect. It is, well, you know, essentially perfect for the conditions for us to live. We couldn't live without some kind of help on Mars, right? We couldn't naturally live on Mars, and we couldn't naturally live on Venus. So this idea, you know, how did this happen? How did this happen? How did we get here? How did these things come to pass? How is it that we're in this perfect zone? How is it that we don't fly off right out of our seats as we're hurtling right now at 67,000 miles per hour? But even knowing these things, we struggle with whether or not we believe in God. Or whether or not, if we do believe in God, if this God is a personal God or just kind of some impersonal force that's out there. There's a lot of good questions, a lot of things that I think we wrestle through. It's just more questions. Do we need God anymore? I find that real common. I've heard Christian leaders that just say to themselves, I've kind of outgrown God. Well, I'm just telling you that there's this sense of do we need God anymore? And some say yes, but they don't always live like it. And some say no, but find God difficult just to completely dismiss. God is kind of persistent in this way. He doesn't, even if we don't understand or we're struggling through what this means to believe in God, God just kind of has this way of pursuing us. At least he does with me. And I'm grateful for that. I think more appropriately, others say, who needs religion? Now, that's a big one here in the United States. Who needs religion? A distrust, basically a deep-seated mistrust in institutional religion, kind of like what we're doing here, quite frankly. People just have a deep mistrust. In fact, more Americans than ever are backing away from religion and consequently from God. And I would argue that not because atheism is that attractive, atheism being that there is no God. I don't think that's the compelling reason. I think the compelling reason for people backing away from the church and from religion is that it's just that atheism's not all that attractive, but religion is less so. There's something that's happened, things that have occurred, things that have been seen that just don't line up. In fact, many people today consider religion or Christianity just religion, I'll just say in general, to be the problem. That religion is actually the problem in the world, and we need to get rid of it and be liberated from that so that we can find our utopia in other ways. So I'm going to touch on something. We just recently remembered 9/11, and so that was actually 20 years ago that happened. But when it happened, there was a temporary surge in religious fervor. The sad thing is, it lasted 2 weekends. Churches were packed for 2 weekends. And we might have expected it to last, but it didn't last. Instead, something else happened. And I'm just going to kind of lay out some things that happened right after 9/11 and just present them to you here. But the first thing that happened is that following the destruction of the World Trade Center, philosopher and neuroscientist Sam Harris began writing a book called The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. Now, this book was a scathing critique of all religions, not just Christianity. It was of all religions in the world. And more than 12 publishers turned it down. With the thought, they thought, well, they didn't really think the U.S. was ready for such a severe critique of Christianity in particular in the United States so soon after what had happened with 9/11. But you know what? The end of faith remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 33 weeks. Millions of people read this book. 2 years later, Richard Dawkins released his best-selling book, The God Delusion. Maybe some of you have seen that or heard about that, The God Delusion. And in his own words, this is his agenda for writing the book. If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. Over 3 million Americans picked up The God Delusion. And it's been translated into 35 languages. So what I'm trying to highlight for you is in this moment when our country went through a national tragedy, and people initially, many people, initially looked to the church for answers in the midst of that time, and I weep in my heart that for whatever reason, it doesn't seem like they found what they were looking for. Because 2 weeks later, they stopped coming. And many of them then bought into and started reading these kinds of things. The critique of religion, and some of it probably just, I don't want to shock you, but some of it probably justifiable. Okay? A justifiable, I'm not going to say all of it was. And I certainly, obviously, as a pastor, don't, you know, endorse the fact that they're trying to turn people away from faith, right? But for some reason, these authors and these ideas took root in our country. And there was a change that began to occur. The following year, so after Dawkins' book, another author, Christopher Hitchens, released his best-selling book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. His book was number one on the New York Times bestsellers list 3 weeks after its release. 3 weeks after its release, it went to number one. So you can see people are reading it. They called themselves the New Atheists, and they gave voice to what a significant percent of the population was already thinking. We don't need God. In fact, religion is the problem. We don't need God. Religion is the problem. Now, in this context, you guys are all acting very shocked, but this is what's been going on over the last 20 years. And we see the proof in the pudding in statistics and numbers and those kinds of things. Their credentials, by the way, they had great credentials, these writers. They were highly intelligent, witty, and they had a kind of a grit that catapulted them to rock star status, especially on college campuses and universities and late night television. And as I've mentioned already, Americans bought their books by the millions. So while a relatively small percentage still of the population has truly read any of these books, a measurable percentage of the population was impacted by these books, as they found their ways into universities. And, you know, that universities are a great place of influence, especially amongst our younger people today. And while, you know, I have a hard time saying few even, but while few stepped into the atheist lane, it's actually about 9% of our population now says that they do not believe in any God, which may not sound like a huge number, but when you think that 30 years ago, that percentage was probably 2%. So it's a number that's increasing with time right now. Millions who were already leaning in that direction stepped out of the religious lane into the unaffiliated. Reminds me of the scene in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And he's sitting in a taxi cab, and one guy saying how his soul got taken by the devil, and another guy got baptized, and then he's sitting in the back seat, and he goes, well, I guess I'm the only one that remains unaffiliated, you know? And but lots and lots of people now, that's their preferred designation. Some have turned them, the term has been used that they are the nuns. They just nothing. Don't affiliate me with any kind of religion or anything at all. And who are the nuns? They are a group that, so I've kind of talked a little bit about the atheists, now we're talking about the nuns. The nuns say they are not hostile toward but are not affiliated with any religion. So they're not as aggressive as maybe an atheist might, and not all atheists are aggressive. In fact, nothing I say about atheists or the nuns, I'm making general statements, okay? So just realize that. There's people that think differently in all these kind of contexts, as they do in the Christian context. But one thing that we do know is that 35% of millennials who are 25 to 40 years of age currently are nuns. So one in three. The majority of them are actually formerly Christian or formerly from the church. They include atheists and agnostics, but most still believe in God, but are theologically agnostic or apathetic. In other words, it's kind of the attitude, don't know, doesn't matter, all people are connected, just be ethical, go light on the God stuff. It's kind of the, again, it's, I'm not trying to caricature, I'm just trying to capture a little bit. And these are people that I know. These are people that you know. These are many, I mean, they're good people, they're smart people, they're whatever you want to say. I'm not here to disparage them. I'm just here to present some thoughts and ideas, okay? So these are the nuns. Their religion is nothing in particular, but it's important in spite of a lack of affiliation. So they have like some kind of, many of them still have some kind of spiritual belief, but there's no affiliation with any kind of institution. In fact, they're tired of institutional religion. As I've said, my heart breaks as I hear so many accounts of people who grew up in church and then abandoned faith. Some who were major Christian leaders. There's a term now for it. It's called deconstructing your faith. And deconstruction can be a good thing if, well, again, from my perspective, deconstruction can be a good thing if you're deconstructing stuff that really you need to deconstruct. Like there's stuff in even in our religious institutions, maybe especially in them, that it might be best to unlearn a few things. But my difficulty with most people that are deconstructing their faith is they're not reconstructing it into anything. And they're caught in this quagmire of deconstruction. And that to me, from my perspective and with those that I've talked to, it seems fairly depressing. Because they've given up something, but they haven't moved to something new. In this series, we want to talk about these things. We want to acknowledge even the failures of the church, and we want to acknowledge your disappointments with God, whoever you are and wherever you are. So let's take a little closer look. My focus here now is on the atheist alternative. And again, I'm just presenting some ideas. They're not just my ideas. These are things that have been gleaned from the writings of the authors that I presented earlier, okay? So, and I'm just sharing some of those thoughts. The idea here, as I've already said too, is that you never walk away from something without walking towards something, right? If you're gonna move away from God, if you're gonna say there is no God, you've made a decision, and then you're turning towards that alternative that there is no God. And my thoughts are for many, maybe some of you who are listening to me again, whether online or even here in the church, if you're going to leave or if you're thinking about leaving, you need to have a good reason, or at least I hope you have a good reason. If you resist the teachings of Jesus, it's important that you are resisting the real thing. Interesting thing about atheism, or even probably the nuns and Christianity, is that people embrace both without really knowing what they're getting themselves into. I think Christians do that all the time. Where people become Christians or they put their faith in God, and then down the road they're like, oh, man, I didn't know it, man. I had to surrender my whole life. You know, like that was, they baited and switched me, you know. They told me it was going to be great. Now I'm going through all this hard stuff. What's up with that? Well, atheism also has consequences. It's actually a fairly complex belief system that logically leads to, I would argue, some unsettling conclusions. But actually, Christianity leads to some unsettling conclusions as well. Did you know that? It does lead to some unsettling conclusions. I just still think that just because they're unsettling or make me uncomfortable doesn't mean they're not still real or true, okay? So you're obviously getting my perspective on that. So to kind of say the same thing again, I don't think most people, now some do, but people don't embrace atheism as much as they let go of religion. People generally are run off from Christianity and find themselves adrift with no theological underpinnings. So let's talk a little bit about atheism today. What does it mean to be an atheist? I've already said this too, but first I want to reiterate that many atheists are smart, well-educated people who probably if I engaged in a debate with them, I would lose. So being an atheist, I'm just trying to say, these are just real people that have thought through stuff in their own heads, and they're intelligent and they're smart, and they've come to certain conclusions about life. Now, there's also a lot of very well-educated, smart, intelligent Christians who've come to a different conclusion. But let's be fair. You know, let's not disparage others who maybe don't share the strong convictions of our faith. Now, I would encourage you to enter into dialogue with them, to have conversations or whatever, but I do not want to be one, even through this series, that's going to put someone else down, you know, for what... Even if I may think to myself, and maybe I should, too early in this series to be saying this, I may still think there's a better way, okay? But that doesn't mean you get what I'm saying. All right. So atheism, and there's probably different ways to express this, but there are kind of six core things that I'm going to share with you today. And I'm not necessarily trying to convince you to become atheist, but I am trying to share with you what's going on in people's thinking and in their lives, okay? So the first thing is the illusion of the mind or soul. In other words, in the realm, if you take God out of the picture, then all you have essentially is biology, chemistry, physics. You just have science. So you are not really you. Seriously, and I'm not just, it's not me just saying this. You are just made up of neurons and protons and chemical things. Your brain is not, there's no soul, because soul is intangible. It's metaphysical. It's not, so it can't be real. So there's no real you. You are just a makeup of molecules and DNA and your brain is operating. In fact, that leads to a thing I'm going to talk about later, but everything's just predetermined because there really is no you. You get what I'm saying? That because the you speaks of the soul. It speaks of something intangible, so it can't be real because we don't believe in the intangible. We're strictly about biology and chemistry and science and physics, things that are more tangible. So your soul is an illusion. The second thing, and I've hinted at it, is the illusion of free will, because everything is governed by the laws of physics. It's determined. There's no room for free will. How can you, if there's no free will, what does that even mean? It's this intangible thing. It's like, how can it be? So there is no free will. And so nobody is responsible for their decisions or the outcome of their decision. And I think we see this creeping into our justice system today. But try living that way. I love this, that even Stephen Hawking, an advocate of determinism, he believes everything is predetermined. There's nothing you can say or do that's going to make any difference because, again, we're all just biological, chemical things just living out life. And he says, I have noticed that even people who claim that everything is predestined and that we can do nothing to change it look before they cross the road. So even Stephen Hawking, in a sense, is kind of, he's like, yeah, I totally believe in the predeterminism and we don't have free will, but he finds it interesting that we still look before we cross the road. I mean, if we're predetermined, who cares? You know, I've actually lived and been in places where culturally It's more fatalistic. And I'm telling you, it is scary to drive there. You know, I'm just being serious. I'm not going to name the country or anything because, again, I'm not trying. But it's scary to drive there because, you know, I'm going down this steep mountain pass and I'm driving a bus and there's 40 people behind me and I see this truck coming up behind me, you know. And on a blind mountain curve on a road with, like, hundreds of feet drop off, the guy just comes around me and just to pass. There's no way he knew what was coming in the other thing. But there's this sense of, well, you know, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. If I'm going to live, I'm going to live. And thankfully, we all lived. So by the way, that quote from Stephen Hawking was from Black Holes and Baby Universes and Other Essays. Okay? The third thing I want to highlight real quick here is the illusion of value. Now this one here, I'm going to say a little bit more because it just struck me so strongly. In a world governed by the laws of physics, there is no inherent or actual value. There is only ascribed or assigned value. Let me try to explain that. Again, and I'm just trying to present it to you. I'm probably not hiding enough how I feel, but I'm just presenting the thoughts to you. So what this means is that there's nothing that actually has value in and of itself. It's just that in my predetermined way of living, I ascribe value to things. Now, this is a big deal, especially when it comes to the idea of justice. Because in the world of chemistry and physics, it means that justice is just what we want it to be. Are you kind of getting this? So, in other words, you are not valuable just because you're a human being. You are only valuable if I ascribe value to you. Or if culture ascribes value to you. You get what I'm saying? Or whatever we're talking about, it's determined, predetermined in this case, but in the way we live out our lives. So we ascribe value. Nothing has inherent value. Now, it's interesting because most people, even many Christians, will say, you have your truth and I have mine. I won't impose my truth on you and you don't impose yours on me. And it's interesting that for the most part in our culture, and even again with many Christians, we're kind of okay with truth being what we want it to be. Again, don't start judging me. I'm just presenting things. But when it comes to justice, it's interesting. When it comes to justice, we want an agreed upon standard to appeal to. You don't hear anyone say, you do your justice and I'll do my justice. But how is justice determined? With no God, there's no objective way to determine justice. How do you determine what's right and what's wrong? There's no plumb line. There's nothing to go by. So it becomes a matter of what the culture tends to think is justice today. And you can see culture's idea of justice has radically changed. Now, I'm sure that many would argue it's for the better. Okay, they would just say our justice today is better than it was before. I'm not here to debate that, not today. But the thing is, justice, the sense of justice is always changing. And it's interesting that today, and I'll go ahead and just address this, it's interesting that today we have something that everybody knows about. It's called the cancel culture. And the cancel culture is basically a somewhat elite or vocal group of people that have established the parameters of what is just and what is not just. And they have their own justice system. And that system basically says, especially if you're someone with a voice or with any kind of position or anything, that if we don't like what you are saying or doing, we are going to, in essence, cancel you. You're going to lose your job. We're not just going to cancel you. We're going to punish you. So our justice system today is no longer, to some degree it is, but it's not really in the courts anymore. That justice system has largely failed, I feel, in many ways anyway. So now the justice system is in the court of public opinion. And you don't hardly know from one day to the next what that justice system is going to be. Why? Because there's no basis for justice. There's no inherent value. There's no sense of what is really right and what is really wrong. Are you with me? All right. I know this is a lot of information, but we're kind of setting this up for the rest of our series. When you take theism out of the picture, when you extract God, we are left again with physics, biology, and chemistry. Value, the sense of ought, the sense of ought not, it all goes away because there's no such thing as value. It's all an illusion. So you can't complain, or I can't complain, if value gets unascribed to me, because the moment I do, I reach out to a world that says, that doesn't exist, basically. I reach out to a world of thought and of soul and of value, but there is no value. Are you kind of following? Am I making some sense? Okay, good. Now, you may object. You may say, I don't believe in God, but I don't believe in all that. Well, then you're not really a good atheist, are you? I mean, I'm just, again, I didn't come up with these six tenets. You can read about them. You can find them in books if you're willing to read them, many of the ones that I've mentioned so far today. The fourth one is that something came from nothing. I'm not going to spend a long time on this, but time, space, and matter had a beginning. Most call it the Big Bang. There's different theories out there, but a singularity. Time, space, and matter came from non-matter, nothing. This makes me wonder, why is there anything? I mean, how does something come from nothing? Again, people a lot smarter than me have some theories or something that tells me, that helps me supposedly understand this. I have to be honest, I don't. In fact, in many ways, I think that this and the next point takes more faith than just believing that there's a God who created everything. But that's, again, I keep letting my biases out of the bag, don't I? Sorry, I can't help myself. So something came from nothing. The fifth thing is that life emerged from no life with no help. Again, I'm not doing very well, I don't think, but I'm trying to resist the temptation because I... Again, I don't believe these things, right? But I just keep wanting to underscore and reiterate that many people around you, if not most, ascribe, whether they realize it as clearly as I'm putting it today, or maybe not so clearly, but, you know, many people that we're interacting with, this is where they're coming from. And many of you watching, maybe this is where you're coming. Maybe those, some of you here, this is where you're coming from. But they're people. They're people who are trying to figure out the meaning and purpose of their lives. Who are trying to figure out, and yes, they've come to maybe to different conclusions, but they're their conclusions. And I will argue strongly that as firmly as I believe in God, as strongly as I believe in a very personal God, we have failed to show respect and to engage in meaningful conversation with those who don't. So this message is not supposed to just be directed towards to those here in the church, but I'm just bringing this out, and I can't say it strong enough. We have got to learn to respect other human beings that don't think and believe the way we do. We have to find a way. I'm not saying you have to agree with them or believe what they believe. Anyway, so the fifth thing here is that first life emerged from no life with no help. Scientists call it biopoiesis. It's the process of non-life becoming life. The improbability, as I said before, of this happening is so high that I think it takes more faith, personally. It almost seems impossible. Because even original life was not simple. Even just a single molecule or a single-celled organism is remarkably and incredibly complex. Even a single-celled organism requires the digital elegance of DNA, which is, and I don't have time to go into, you know, all the scientific stuff about DNA and the complexity of life, but basically the sense is that that this life came from nothing. There was nothing, and then something happened, and we have something, okay? Because you can't, again, if you are committed to there not being a God, then this is how that has to happen, right? All right? So I got one more. You guys still with me?
Yes.
All right, good. So the last thing is that natural selection is responsible for all life after first life. So basically the survival of the fittest. So natural selection does not explain the origin of life. They're two completely different things. But the natural selection is that something that kind of started begins to create hierarchies and develop systems and all these kinds of different things. In fact, Richard Dawkins wrote this. He said, think about it. On one planet, molecules that would normally make nothing more complicated than a chunk of rock gathered themselves together into chunks of rock-sized matter of such staggering complexity that they are capable of running, jumping, swimming, flying, seeing, hearing, capturing, and eating other such animated chunks of complexity, capable in some cases of thinking and feeling and falling in love with yet other chunks of complex matter. Well, the thing is, this is good. This is a highly intelligent human being who does not believe in God by his own admission, who has to try to take a look at the world. It's fascinating to me that he just kind of states it as a fact. Again, I'm still letting my biases out here. But he noticed that what we are, what you and I are, we're just chunks of complex matter. That's all we are, chunks of complex matter. You guys are terrible, man. I understand. And you've heard my heart, though, in this matter, and I won't repeat it, okay? So, but...
We can love them, we just don't have to understand them.
Yeah. Or we can try to understand, and so we can have a conversation with them. Anyway, if you don't, so let me just wrap this up, because there was a lot of material here. If you don't believe in God, or you're on the verge of giving up on God, I'm just going to say again, it's probably not because you're fascinated by the alternative. It's probably far more personal than that. Something has happened. Things you've seen, things you've witnessed, something you don't, you know, the typical, not typical, but the common question is that if there was a God, you know, if there truly was a God, why does that God let so many evil things happen on the earth? By the way, that's a very valid question. I think I have a conversation I could have with you about that, but it's a very valid question and one that many people feel very deeply. And it's probably one of the, next to just the failure of Christians or religious people, I'll broaden it out even, I would say it's probably one of the highest reasons why people don't believe in God or struggle with God.
And it's a hard answer.
Yeah. And if they didn't believe in God totally, I guess they wouldn't struggle with the question, right? So there's probably something they want. There's something there, all right? So my encouragement to you as we're closing is that if you have lost or are losing faith in God, over these next 5 more weeks now, we're going to do our best to show you or to just talk with you about the fact that maybe the God you've lost faith in, at least your understanding of that God, or the situations that happen, maybe that particular God doesn't actually really exist anyway. Like a lot of times I think people get disappointed with the God that they kind of made up in their own mind, a certain expectation that we put on God, and then that God disappoints us. And so we wash our hands of the whole God idea, or try to, and walk away. Now, I'm not here to say, man, I got the handle. I know all there is to know about God. I can tell you, you know. But I do think that, and I'll say, again, I'm too early in this series to say this, but I'm saying it anyway. I do think Jesus has a handle. Amen. So that, I'll just say that. Amen. So my purpose today really was to shine kind of a light on the alternative. Because if we are wrestling in our hearts and our thoughts about possibly walking away from God, or if anybody watching has done that or is thinking about doing that, I just kind of wanted to give you a little bit of a glimpse into what the alternative is. And you know what? If that's the way you go, I mean, I can't stop you from doing that, right? But I just want you to kind of have an idea. I mean, the alternatives, you know, which this will, again, don't judge me, which may be true, okay? Just hear me out. But this is if it is true, it says you have no value. There's no sense of justice that spans over the course of time and cultures. There's no ought or ought nots. There's no mind, there's no you. Because we're just a predetermined, complex chunks of matter. But I'll be honest with you. We hope not. We hope that is not the end. We hope there is more. We hope we are more as human beings. But our only hope for that hope, we're going to argue, is God. So who needs God? I would argue perhaps we all do. And we're going to discuss that, and we're going to have a couple other messages that are dealing a little bit still more with the alternative, and then we'll turn the corner. But I hope you come back, or you watch again, and kind of hear how this plays out over the next few weeks. I'm going to say a prayer. We got one final song that we're going to sing together. But Lord, I just ask right now. My heart, Lord, is to acknowledge that for many people around us and in this world today, it's hard to believe in God. It seems... Or we may believe in God, but we wrestle with, if there is a God, what's God like? Does God really care about me? And many have had experiences, Lord, and I want to just acknowledge and validate those even in this prayer. I've had experiences, Lord, that don't add up. Make it difficult for them to see, how could there be a God if this is what happened in my life? And I just pray over these next few weeks, Lord, that as we are gathered together or watching online, that and as we wrestle with these questions, Lord, as we wrestle with whether there even is a God. And if you are God, I mean, I'm praying right now to you, God. But if you're real, are you personal? Do you really care? Are we just chunks of matter walking around on this earth, predetermined in everything that's going to happen and all that we do? It may sound funny coming from a pastor, but I think those are legitimate questions until we hopefully find ourselves in you. I had those questions, Lord. I wrestled through those things, and I'm grateful that they led me to you. Yeah. Just commit these few words in the weeks to come. And pray, Lord, even as we're going to sing here, but and we sang earlier, Lord, that you would reveal yourself. That you'd show yourself to us and to those who are seeking or wondering. We're asking you to do that.